Welcome to Grief is My Side Hustle. You all know that my podcast is one of my favorite things that I get to do every week. Today, it's just insane. It's another one of those stories of someone I've lightly stalked online for a long time. Although this time, our meet cute happened on Threads, which I'm like basically brand new to Threads. I have a new friend, Amy Morin, who is here with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I wish that we met under different circumstances. Like, I wish your podcast were like, winning the lottery is my side hustle, and we connected on Threads via that. However, such is life that we...
Okay, I love that idea. Someone hit that up right now. Winning the lottery is my side hustle, and we'd like to interview all the people who won the lottery. That is genius. Thank you. That was our little meeting on Threads. You had commented on someone else's thread supporting them, but hadn't outed yourself as this extraordinary author of multiple books that are widely beloved. And I said to you a minute ago, I've picked your book up multiple times in Target and just loved having the excuse to purchase it and buy it this time as my homework. And you have many of them, but I love the theme of them are 13 things mentally strong people don't do. So you have a number of books that are the number 13. So I want to ask about that. But they are really palatable ways of exploring concepts that you believe are really important in helping people to thrive. Is that a fair way of describing it?
That's a great way to put it. Yep.
There you go. See, I told you I read the book. But before we jump in, so one of the things I said to you before we got started is your book was not what I expected. It has this book is going to give me advice vibe. And when you open it and crack it open, it's a really powerful personal story. And it's really special. So I'm so honored you're here, and I want to dive in, and I'm going to ask the question I ask all my guests, which is, what brings you into the world of grief and loss?
Oh, yeah, good question. The club that none of us want to join, but we're all going to at some point. For me, it was when I was 23. My mom passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. I had just become a therapist, and my mom had a brain aneurysm. And she was fine one minute and gone the next. I was literally on the phone with her shortly before she passed away. And that was rough. I had expected her to be in my life for my adulthood. So I was just thinking, boy, how do I go through the rest of these things and all the things my mother had dreamed of, from retirement and having grandkids? And she didn't get to do that. And to see my dad by himself, my parents were married when they were 18 and 19.
Oh my God.
So to see my dad alone for the first time was awful. Oh boy, it was a rough few years. And shortly after my mom passed away, my dad's house caught on fire, which meant all of my mother's belongings were smoke damaged, and the house didn't burn down, but we had to take everything out of the house to get it professionally cleaned. And because there was so much smoke and water damage. So now we found ourselves going through all of her belongings right after she passed away and having to make decisions like, are we going to really hang her clothes back up in the closet? That didn't make sense, but we weren't ready to go through her stuff yet either. So that just added insult to injury. And then to see my dad living in a motel for a while, his house was being fixed up, it was rough. And then 3 years to the day that my mom died, my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack. It was the 3-year anniversary, and the eeriest of experiences. I lived in Maine at the time, and in Maine in February, it's cold and there's nothing to do, but there are high school basketball tournaments at an auditorium. And I had gone with my mom the night before she passed away to watch relatives play basketball, and it was fun. I didn't go back to that auditorium because it was eerie. I'm always like, oh, that's the last place I saw my mom. 3 years later, my husband and I were like, how are we going to spend this? And one of my best friends from growing up had said, hey, do you want to go watch our old hometown play in a basketball game? And I thought about it, and I was like, I don't know about going back to the auditorium, but let's do it. And so we did. And then I went home that night, and my husband had a heart attack. And I'm 26. I don't have my mom. I just had this incredibly eerie experience of being at the same auditorium when I lost my mom, and then I lost my husband. And then it just gets even weirder. Like, shortly after my husband died, like a week and a half later, my grandmother's house catches on fire. It was like almost this weird... What is going on in the universe?
It's biblical.
And I'm supposed to be a therapist, and I'm supposed to help other people with their problems, but I was in rough shape, to say the least. I got 3 days of bereavement time, as if I could go back to work 3 days after losing my husband. Fortunately, my sister's also a therapist, and she took me to the, I had applied for short-term disability, and they said, yeah, we don't cover grief. And so she marched me into the doctor's office, and she said, diagnose her with depression and acute stress disorder. And my doctor did, and my short-term disability kicked in, because they'll cover depression and acute stress disorder, but they won't cover grief. That bought me a couple of months off, and I was grateful for that, because I couldn't, it wasn't even an option. But on the other hand, I had to work and I had to pay the bills. My husband was a primary breadwinner, so I needed income. And so I eventually did have to go to work after a couple of months, but that luckily turned into writing became my side hustle so that I could pay the bills. I started writing a few articles. I couldn't, as a therapist, obviously you can only work so many hours a week. 40 hours was my limit. And that, like in the evenings and on the weekends, I didn't always have the energy while I was grieving to have another job. So I started writing, and because I could write if I felt like it, if I didn't, that was okay. And that helped me pay the bills for a few years. And then I was fortunate. I found love a few years later. And I thought, I never thought I'd get remarried, but I did. And then just about the time I got remarried, my father-in-law got diagnosed with cancer. And at first they said, don't worry, it's beatable. It's prostate cancer. But then it was pretty clear it was terminal. And I was just like, I can't lose another person. I literally just spent a whole decade of my life grieving. The thought of losing one more person was unbearable, but obviously I didn't have a choice. And so I write myself a letter of what mentally strong people don't do. I would read it every day. So I thought, all right, just don't do these things, Amy, and you'll be okay. And then I thought, geez, if this is helpful to me, maybe it will help somebody else. So I put it online. I got paid $15 for it. And it was the 13 things mentally strong people don't do list. There was no context of why I wrote it, but it went viral, like really viral. Forbes picked it up and it got 10 million views. And then Business Insider picked it up and got 30 million views over there. And it just kept growing. And everybody knew I was a therapist. So they thought, oh, this is great. You mastered all of these things. Nobody knew the backstory. So there's interviews. I'm on Fox News and Forbes and talking about mental strength, but nobody knew. My father-in-law actually passed away a couple of days before I went on national TV to talk about all of this. And it wasn't until, and then one of the people that read the article was a literary agent who said, you should write a book. And the book came out a year later. But and then shortly, it wasn't too long after all of that happened too, that I was a foster parent. And one of my former foster children passed away from a heroin overdose. And so needless to say, there was a decade of my life where I just felt like everybody around me was dropping like flies. And I was thinking, who's next?
Yeah.
And then I'm supposed to be a therapist. And then it's, as a strange twist of fate, I write an article that goes viral. And one of the best things that could have happened came out of this really dark, awful day in my life. So that's the long version of how I got to be on your podcast and why I can talk about grief from a personal standpoint too.
I've been following your platform for a little while. And again, I feel like the part that you just described, which is, hey, here's the list of the things, follow the list. That part is there and available for people to see. I want to know what that was like for you to have gone already through so much, to have written this list for yourself from a place of deep pain, and to be sitting with people, publishers, pundits, who want to elevate you as the wise person who's come up with this great list of things because she's a therapist, when the reality is it's because the world handed her a shitstorm.
Yeah, at first I thought I had probably ruined my career. So Psychology Today came out with an article that was all the things wrong with the 13 things mentally strong people don't do.
Oh, snap.
And I went to work. I'm still working as a therapist. I went into the office and I said, I just did something awful. Like, I didn't mean to do this. I wrote this article for $15 because I was trying to pay the light bill. And I think I made a huge mistake. And we talked about it, and they said, no, my supervisor thankfully was like, no, it's okay. You can write an article like that. You didn't say anything terrible. And it turned out to work out well because Psychology Today actually gave me a job and I got a writing position with them too. So in the end, it turned out well. But at first I just thought, this is awful. And the literary agent who said, you should write a book, I ignored her at the moment. I didn't even know what a literary agent was. I right. didn't know how things went. Right. My phone was ringing off the hook. It was insane. MTV in Finland called, and CNN in Mexico, and all of these people are calling saying, let's talk about this viral piece you wrote. And I didn't tell anybody. It was like a while before I said to my agent, even once I finally did sign up with her, I figured out when I went to New York to be interviewed for a bunch of things, I met her in person and saw the books in her office. And I thought, oh, you really do represent big books. I
Yeah,
said,
this
but
is real.
I said, I have a secret. I didn't write this because I mastered it. I wrote it because I'm struggling with it. And I don't want to tell my story to the world. I'm a therapist and I'm skilled at listening to people's stories. I don't want to share mine. And I didn't want to for a couple of reasons. One was I worked in a rural therapy office and I said, I don't want people coming into my therapy office to know all of this stuff because it may affect their ability to talk to me. But also from a human standpoint, I'm an incredibly private person normally. And I thought to put my life out there, I don't know that I want to do that, even if it's the opportunity to write a book. And I didn't want to talk about other people. It's one thing if I decide I'm going to talk about my life, but I'm talking about like my family and my friends and other people in my life too. So I thought, I don't really want to do that and put all of that out there because I know once you put it out there, you can't take it back.
Yeah. What I keep thinking about is how young you were, right? Like you were a baby in moments. That's 23 is you're just trying to figure out who you are. You're like holding on to the railing still. And so I have so much compassion for this idea that like you wrote this list. I'm almost 50 now and I have all these notebooks of like reminders to myself and mantras and things that I'm trying to manifest because you and I know it's important to expose yourself to that kind of positive work in your life. But what I think about when I think about you writing this list is like in grief, we're so lost. And it's so exhausting to just do what needs to be done, whatever that might look like. That the idea that you wrote yourself this list almost like as a, and we'll talk a little bit about it, but a little bit of a just remember what is the most important. And it has both like a cheerleading quality, but also a handrail or a light in the dark feeling to it to me.
And that's just it, because I felt like there were so many things I could do. And of course, people offer you lots of advice when you're going through grief of go for a walk, drink a glass of water, just get out there and hang out with people or all sorts of. And I thought there's so many things I could do. I don't want any more things on a list of things I should be doing today to make me feel worse because I can hardly function. It was really a list of what not to do that I thought this is manageable. If I just wake up today and don't do these things,
That's
by the end of
right.
the day, I'll be okay and I'll get through it.
That's right. And so was 13 random, or did you just land on 13 and because that's how many things you wanted to not do, or does 13 have a significance to you?
Yeah, there was no significance to it. It was just over the years as a therapist, I figured out people who don't do these things tend to do better. And I just paid attention to that and noticed that. And I'm supposed to be a strengths-based therapist, right?
Yeah.
You point out what people are doing well and you keep telling them to do that. I was like, at some point, I'm doing people a disservice if I don't also point out, hey, despite the 17 great habits you have, this one thing's keeping you stuck. So it started paying attention to that out of my own interest over the years. After I lost my mom, I remember thinking some of the people that come into my therapy office are still optimistic and kind and hopeful people. And they had been through incredible loss and tragedy and hardship, and sometimes over and over again. And I thought, what separates these people from the rest of us who struggle? And one of the things I saw was they just don't have these certain bad habits. They refuse to do these things, feel sorry for themselves. And so when I sat down to write myself a letter, it was really just what have I learned over the years, the list of it, and then didn't really think about putting it out there with the number 13 or anything like that. It just so happened. I think it probably helped it go viral because there's so much mystery around the number 13 that
Sure.
people were intrigued to click on it, but certainly wasn't part of my plan.
I think of grief as this full contact sport. And, you know, you're coming home at the end of the day, having not run accounting software. You know, you come home at the end of the day, having sat with people who are asking you to bear witness and hold space and all those therapy words for their experiences. They don't know what your experience is, right? That boundary is there for your clients. But how does the writing fit in? Was it a now I get to write, now I need to write, now I better write? Like, how did it become part of your grief process?
So my biggest fear was having to move. My husband and I had bought a house. And so I felt so grateful that I had this house. I loved my house. I loved everything about it. And I thought, I don't want to pack up and move. Especially after my mom passed away and we had this fire, we had to touch all of her stuff and move it all so fast. I couldn't pay the bills. And I couldn't come up with anything to pay the bill. I thought, I can't go wait tables after work, after I'm done at the therapy office. I'm wiped out most days. So when I came home and I could write an article, and I didn't write about anything therapeutic, it had nothing to do with my day job. I would write 7 things you should do in New York City on a weekend trip with your kids.
Yep.
Completely different, but I remember, and I would get $15 to $25 per article back then. And I thought, this is amazing. I could pump out 4 of these in an evening and make $100. But if I'm having a really bad day and I'm wiped out from work, I don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And I'll just take the evening off. But also on the weekend, because you know how time
Oh,
when you're grieving,
so lonely. Yes.
sometimes you dread the weekends or you dread
Yes,
a
that's a
Friday
real
night.
thing.
Because I then thought, I'm not just sitting here by myself all weekend long. I'm doing something. There was action I could take. That helped me so much because I thought, all right, if I sit here and I crank out 5 articles today on this Saturday, I feel really good about how I just spent my weekend because I'm earning money. I can pay my bills. And I think it was that just gave me like something to do. So it helped with my grief, but also helped me feel like I was making progress so that I didn't feel like I had to move. It empowered me to say, okay, you can pay the bills this month and you can keep this roof over your head. And I didn't want to ask other people to help me, or I had incredibly kind people that I'm sure would have, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to figure out what's a long-term plan? How am I going to keep this running on my own? And that gave me hope that I could do it.
And it sounds, what's interesting about it is that you're talking about, I have the skill set, I can do it, it will help me make money. And you just said something really important, which is the unstructured time on the weekend for people that are grieving anything, any
Yep.
kind of loss is brutal. And lots of the, and it also has that, oh, everyone else thinks of the weekend positively, but I'm just
Yeah.
looking until there's something that I have to do or some purpose or some, so I really, that resonates, and I know it's going to resonate for my listeners. What I'm so fascinated by is this idea that, like, you had a fire around wanting to be able to provide because the notion of moving was like a bridge too far, like another loss that we can't possibly. And you had a tangible skill that could make you money. So it that was because lots of people talk about writing as the process and getting their thoughts out of their head. That's not the writing you were doing. You weren't doing that writing. You were writing about trips to New York and the 7 things that you should do with your kids.
I found sites that would just allow back in the day, they don't really do them anymore because it doesn't work for search engines. But back then, where you could just create content and it would, there'd be a headline and you can pick which headlines you want to write and you create a 600 word article, boom, you're done. And I found that incredibly. There's no way I could have written stuff about therapeutic content or that I could have really written about my experience in the moment. Instead, I just wanted to do something else and writing seemed easy to me at the time.
And then writing becomes the thing that allows you to pivot, make a big pivot in your career and reinvent how you want to help people out in the world.
I probably wrote, I would say it was probably 7 years later, and I had probably written thousands of articles in 7 years. Again, most of them were just incredibly sterile things about vacations or something like that. This is what, like the first one that it wasn't about me, and people didn't know it was about me, but it was more mental health related. I really hadn't written a lot of things about mental health, and it was one of the first ones. Never imagined it would go viral. Had I known it was going to go viral, and I would have double checked it. I would have done things differently. I would have edited a lot more. So I certainly had no idea that would happen.
That is such a fascinating thing because I think people have different relationships now with putting things out in the world, right? It can be a reel, it can be something you've written, it can be pictures of your kids or whatever. But it's always so fascinating that there are people out there that are like, this is how you go viral, and this is what you have to do, and this is how you make it happen. And every person that I have ever met whose life has changed because of a viral article or something that they did, it was a complete accident.
Yep.
You know, Megan, I did 16 other things. Maggie Smith, who's a friend of mine, she wrote the poem Good Bones, and alongside several other poems that she says she thought were better.
Yeah.
But Good Bones is the one that the internet inhaled and chewed up and changed her the trajectory of her whole career. It's just a very funny thing to hear you say. Maybe I would have vetted it with someone. Or just,
and I absolutely would have. And if somebody had predicted would this go viral, there's no way. But and then to see it happen, Juliette Lewis put it on Facebook. I remember my sister-in-law was like, Amy, I see your article on Juliette Lewis's Facebook page. Don Cheadle tweeted it. It just like all of these celebrities were sharing it. And I just it was just such a strange firestorm for a while.
And also powerful, right? So something to realize that whether you intended it or not, here's the platform where maybe you can serve or meet the universe with what it needs, what it's hungry right. for. And what people can't see right now is you got a whole bunch of books behind you. So this one sort of starts it all, but it starts it all. And you, it turns out you have plenty more to say in this format that turns out to be really palatable and something that people are hungry for.
Yeah, it started out as one book and I thought, oh, that's cool. I'm a therapist and I got to write a book and kept my day job and didn't even really tell that many people I worked with that there was a book. I just kept it completely under wraps. The book did okay when it came out, but it didn't. 50 million people read the article. 50 million people did not read the book. And so I thought, that's okay. That's still so cool. I got to write a book. I was so grateful for it. And I didn't hit any bestsellers lists. And I had always heard the only time you hit a bestsellers list is when it's launched. And it took a year and a half before I hit a bestsellers list and thought, oh, maybe I could write a second book. And now it's been 10 years and I have 6 books on the shelf and I still get to speak about mental strength. And I do a lot of the same things I did in the therapy office, but now I get to do it in different ways. I have a podcast and I get to speak to bigger audiences and my books are in 40 something languages. So it's all because of that 600 word article I wrote on a really bad day.
So let that be a lesson to us all. Can you talk about the big shift that happens? So we talk about on this podcast, the before and afters and the way you are coming to us with a lot of grief in that you have survived, right? And for a lot of people, they're picking up this podcast at week 3, week 5, where they want to believe what you're saying, which is there could be love in the future and there could be a career in the future and there could be, but right now they're in the water and trying not to drown. We all remember those days. Can you just talk a little bit about sort of the transformation? Like even when you're talking about going viral, that sounds really scary to me. So it sounds a little out of control, like exciting, but also out of the window of tolerance.
Right? Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about what has it taken to get from the space where everything feels like chaos and where you are right now? And feel free to quote your book if that makes sense.
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. I think for most of my life, I lived a pretty boring, safe life. I really like to know what's going to happen tomorrow. I hate uncertainty to this day. And when I felt like the day that my mom died, my life got flipped upside down. And to be honest, it's never felt the same and it never will. Took me a while to get to that conclusion that life was never going to be normal again.
Right.
And it's felt like I was in the washing machine just getting tumbling around for so long and I didn't know which way was up and which way was down. And I remember saying, I'm a therapist, I should have words to describe what this is. And the only phrase I could come out of my mouth for a long time was like, it hurts to breathe. And I just remember thinking after my husband died, you got to be kidding me, really? Like, when is it going to end? Like, when is the pain going to end? When is this going to stop? How is it going to feel better? And I guess I remember coming to that conclusion, maybe it's not. Maybe my life is never going to, I'm never going to get that same peace that I felt once in my life. And maybe I just have to accept that from here on out, I can still live a good life if I choose to, but it's not ever going to be quite like it was. And so I started doing some things. Like I got a motorcycle. And I'd always thought it would be like cool to have a motorcycle, but I never would have done it before because I just liked this really safe life that I had. So I was like, all right, I'll buy a motorcycle and see if that helps. Wow. And I used to drive it over to my husband's grandmother's house in the evening sometimes. If I wasn't writing an article, I'd just take my motorcycle over to say hi to her. It was like, I felt a little bit alive if I did that.
Yeah.
And then one of the things, and I talk about this in the book too, is for my husband's birthday, my mother-in-law and I decided to make these crazy adventures just as something to do. It's like we went skydiving on his birthday the year after he died. And I think that was something that just said, all right, his birthday is never going to be the same again, but what am I going to do to make it different? And we didn't want to feel sorry for ourselves. So that was what we came up with. And we've done we took flying trapeze lessons and ridden mules into the Grand Canyons. And it's a tradition that we've held on to this day. And even though I'm remarried, we still do try to do something on his birthday every year. And that was something too, that just said, okay, I'm not waiting anymore for life to go back to the way it was. I'm going to have to create a new normal moving forward. And I never thought I would get remarried. And I remember people saying, "You're young, honey, you'll find love again."
Oh,
and I
isn't
just
that the best when
yeah, as I'm a therapist, and I'm just like, I would like to smack you for saying that. Or people that would be like, "I know just what you're going through because I lost somebody," and you're thinking,
"Did you?
No, you
Do
don't."
you know exactly what I'm going through? Yeah.
And I never thought that would happen. And I never thought so many things in my life would happen. I was so shy, I barely spoke most of my life. Like, my sister and my friends spoke for me. And it wasn't until I gave the eulogy at my husband's funeral that suddenly I was like, public speaking's not the scariest thing on the planet.
I can do it. Turns out. I can do it under the circumstance.
I think part of me realized that. I was like, the worst things that could have happened to me happened. Not that I would like to tempt God to try anything else, but I feel like I have been through the worst things, like the biggest fears in my life. I had grown up with incredible separation anxiety from my mother. My biggest fear would be that I'd lose her someday. And then after I lost my mom, I think my biggest fear was like, what if something ever happened to my husband? And so then I think, okay, I've survived those two things. Like, I can do a lot more than I ever thought I could have. And even though I was a therapist telling other people like, hey, you can probably get out there and do things you don't think you can, I really had to put that to the test and say, yeah, maybe I can do these things. And so I think it slowly evolved over time, where I remember getting through the first year where you're just white knuckling it. And then the second year came around and I think, all right, how do I white knuckle it a little bit less? Yeah. How do I feel if this is what my life's? I felt secure that I could stay in my house, but what else do I want? My friends were all getting married and having kids. I had to make some decisions. Do I want to go become a foster parent again? We had been foster parents when my husband passed away. Do I want to be a single foster mom? Yeah, I decided I did. And I'm going to try something new, get a motorcycle. And then I had to give up a lot of the dreams that we had too. It was slowly letting their dreams die. My husband and I had this boat that he loved, but I was like, I don't love boating without him. He made it fun. Without him, it's not fun. I'm going to sell the boat. Little things like that, where it was figuring out what dreams do I hold on to? Which ones am I going to let go of? And I think it was just a gradual process then of saying, okay, and what kind of a life do I want to live, given this is the hand that I was dealt?
God, that's such a great answer. And I'm listening to you talking about it, like as a human and a person, and also somebody with a therapeutic background. But in the grief world, part of what you're talking about is the dual process model, which is like you orient towards the pain. And in the beginning, that's what you're looking at. All your pain, all you've lost, all the bad. And then there maybe are some minutes in those days where it's like neutral. And then if you have kids or people who need you right in way, maybe you are forced or pulled to make some decisions. Are we selling the house? What are we doing with the car, the boat? Like, you're pulled, but you don't want to be there. But eventually, when people don't get really mired in it, like, there is this orientation towards living. Right. And I just think about that. I think about how hard it is to believe. Like, my phrase when my mom died was, I just don't know who I am. Unbeknownst to me, the 20-year trauma veteran, unbeknownst to me, I still had a lot of codependency with my mom that existed. And I just was like, I literally don't know who I am or where to go or what to do. I was so disoriented. It was like being in the ocean with no instruments and no stars, and I could just see nothing. And at some point, you got to get out of the ocean, or you got to get to dry land. And sometimes the way that you get there is just by not dying, by somehow surviving. And then what I love, and you write beautifully about this, like the choice to do things that you've never done before, I believe is literally how you become someone who lives past a loss. You're carrying the loss with you the rest of your life, but novelty, which is terrifying and really hard. I remember when I moved into this house that I have lived in for almost 8 years, it was just after my dad died. And I was like, he's never going to know that I lived here. Like, he can't picture me here. He won't. He was never in this house. And that was so painful, but also an indication of we're still living the life. And it's this slow process. And I think for different people, there's more time spent in pain and more time spent in neutral, or like we're rushing towards. But you write in your book, and if it's okay to quote,
sure.
I love this chapter about, it's chapter 7, and it's of your 13 things. It's that mentally strong people don't dwell on the past. Can you talk about, so I have chills even just reading that out loud. Can you talk about that? Because knowing, I hit that chapter and I was like, yeah, but, oh my God, her story is so hard. If she wants to dwell on the past, can you talk a little bit about why that's so important?
Yeah, for me, like you said, the weird things about, I didn't want to move because this, my loved one won't know that I... But, and it's a strange thing in your brain to try to figure out, like, why am I concerned about this? And yet, what does that mean? And if I do, and how's that going to affect my past memories? And then how I feel about the future? And in my case, like, for a long time, I didn't want to do anything, like, differently. I didn't want to get rid of a scrap of paper that my husband had written something on, because I thought, what if I find this piece of paper and it's something I never read before? It was almost like I thought I could then create some new memories with him, even though he wasn't right here. I remember reading the books that he had read that I had never read before, because I thought it's almost like I'm somehow doing something with him. If I know he read this stack of books and I read them, that it almost felt like then I'm somehow creating new memories with him.
They call that continuing bonds in grief theory, which is you're trying to bring them into your present moment by interacting with the sort of memory of them.
Yes. And that's exactly what it was. And I didn't have the language. I didn't know what it was. It was just what I wanted to do. And the thought of getting rid of anything, you know, his toothbrush sat right on the sink for so long. And I kept his jacket where he hung it up. And I'd get irritated if somebody came in my house, some well-meaning friend or close family member, and they were trying to tidy up or do something in those early days. And I didn't want anybody to touch anything. And so it took a while to figure out, how do I also move forward, and to know that if I learn something new, my memory of my loved one isn't going to fall out the other side of my brain. Yes. Because I can remember thinking like that my brain has so much capacity, and if I form new memories, the old ones fade away. Or if I allow myself to move forward, the further away I'm becoming from my loved ones. And so I wanted to figure out, how do I acknowledge that the past happened? I'm grateful that I had these amazing people in my life, and yet I can still be happy in the present and I can look forward to the future. And I knew that if I just dwelled in the past, I couldn't do that. And in order to move forward, I don't say you move on, but in order to move forward as life was moving forward, whether I wanted it to or not, I had to come to that conclusion of, it's not about every little thing. It's not about that last little piece of paper that I found, or if I came across something I'd never read before, or had never seen before, like it wasn't gonna be that monumental life-changing thing that I thought that it was.
Yeah.
And I think it was about accepting that yes, I could still enjoy the moments, and I could let go of the fact that I no longer living in the past, and looking through old photo albums and things could bring me joy. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. But I can also, I don't have to just get together with friends and rehash the old days. We can get together and make new memories. And that's okay, to give myself permission to do that.
So what I particularly loved about this, again, because you have a clinical background, is, and I don't know if you were trained this way, but I was trained to, when someone was going through or had just gone through something really awful, to tell them to keep their movements slow. Don't cut things. Don't move to Arizona. Don't change. Don't quit your job. And so really, without challenging that, and that comes from the world of sobriety as well, but it's really about, don't do more than your system can handle. But when, particularly when there's sudden loss, which you went through multiple times, you go from 813 to 814, and at 814, you are a different person.
Right.
And I don't mean everything about you is different, but the life in 813 is no longer available to you. It is gone. Now you have a new life, which is going to be including this profound loss that you're going to have to learn how to carry. I always think of it as like a toddler on my hip that I have to learn how to carry. And because when you carry a toddler for a long time, it gets less hard to do and you learn how to do it. But in the beginning, it's pretty horrifying. when you are talking about this, I'm really thinking about the people who need permission to understand that it's not a betrayal to the life they had or the life that they lived or the, because I think many people have an urgency or an instinct to do something novel, something totally new, something that they wouldn't. And maybe it's like the motorcycle, which is all the bad things happen to me. So fuck it. Might as well buy a motorcycle. Maybe it's partly that, but I think it might even be more broad, which is I have to learn how to become a person in this world. It reminds me of teenagers who like come downstairs and they're preppy one day and the next day they come downstairs and they're goth. And the next day they're trying to figure out who am I in this world? And in the world of grieving and in the existence of, oh my God, this is my reality now. Some of that stuff, some of that newness is about trying to find your footing on a sphere that's spinning through the universe that feels like it shouldn't be anymore.
That's just it. When my husband Lincoln died, I remember waking up the day that I finally started going back to work. And I thought, I don't really even know how to get ready in the morning without him here. We used to get ready for work at the same time and eat breakfast together and have these conversations. And so I could see, my thing was, I'm going to stay here, but I could see how somebody else would say, I'm going to move to a different place, get a new job and start over because what am I doing? If I'm staying here, am I just going to go through the same routine? And yet there's an empty chair on the other side of the table. Yeah. There were days that I thought, yeah, if I just move somewhere else and had a completely fresh start.
But I was really serious that I can't do things the way that they were. I need to pivot and I need us to pivot. And your chapter, the wisdom, again, of don't dwell in the past is... in grief, I'll just say it quickly. When you look into the past, you evoke inside your body the experience, the emotional experience of that past, and you bring it into the present. And in good grief work, then you move it through your body again. You transform it again. But if you're just looking to the past, evoking that energy and bringing it into the present, then you're looking to the future with this pain that's from the past, right? So you
that's
are
a great way to put all of that. Yes,
isn't that incredible? That's not me. Lisa Feldman Barrett writes about this, and it's really how the brain works. The brain is predicting based on how you feel right now and past experiences what it thinks is going to happen in the future. And it's so important sometimes to do things that are completely new when you're trying to become a griever.
Yep.
Because otherwise you're dragging that pain that you're trying to metabolize it. You're going to carry it in a way that's going to limit you. So I just loved, again, your book really was like a little whispering. I didn't know that I was going to feel so much camaraderie in the understanding, both as, oh, I understand you because I have also had profound loss. Your compound loss is unlike anything I have heard before. And I really, reading these words, I was like, oh, she is building the scaffolding she needs for herself. And then, oh my God, the whole world wants it. They don't even understand why they want it. They don't get why they want it. But it's, oh, the secret is it was built from, this is a phoenix. Like it was built from the like hellfire of a hurricane and then a tornado and then an earthquake. Of course you want what's here because it's like holy and sacred and it's what keeps you alive. That's a little bit melodramatic the way that I'm describing it. But if people don't have this book, I haven't read your other books yet, so I cannot speak to them. But if people don't have them, I really hope that they will, as they're listening, go and order it from their local bookstore right now and come find your podcast and find you on social media, because the one thing that is the most striking and I think so important for people who are in fresh grief is you have a big smile. You are living a really big life. I believe that you grieve all the time, but you present and are a very happy person. And that is the fear. The fear for those of us that have been in profound loss is that we are never going to find that place for ourselves again.
And that was my fear for a long time. And I thought, I'll paste on a smile, but I felt like I will probably always be faking it. And that was my worries. I thought, oh, can I just to make other people feel okay if I smile enough, will that work? But my life is completely flipped upside down from where it used to be. I now live on a sailboat in the Florida Keys and I'm remarried. I've written 6 books. I get paid to speak to people all over the globe. And again, I used to be the shy person that lived in rural Maine and had a really safe life. So it's a completely different life than I ever imagined that I would have. Yet I feel like I'm doing okay. I appreciate things a lot more than I used to. And I get so many things in life that I didn't necessarily have before. I didn't even know I was missing them. And that's not to say that I don't still miss my people. Yeah. I certainly do. Sometimes people are like, this is great that happened to you because you went through rough times. I'm like, well, it doesn't really even out. Trust me.
I would do anything to have them back.
Right? Like, come it's on. Really cool. I got to write a book. But yeah. At the same time, I have to say it's a different life than I imagined. However, the experience that I get now are amazing and better than I could have ever dreamed about.
I'm so appreciative of that. And again, for the people who are listening and are, hey, you guys, fuck off, because I'm never going to feel better. We also want to honor that and hear that. Yep. We're part of this podcast job is to offer you a little hope balloon. And we'll just say it again, because it needs to be said. Nobody is saying you're not going to grieve your beloveds, or if it's not people, the relationship that you lost or the health that has changed. We're never, ever trying to tell you that you're not going to wish that your people were here.
Right.
It doesn't have to be the end of all good things that happen in your life. And I feel like that's probably what makes the power of your story the kind of thing that 50 million people want to read the list and want to come and hear you and pick up your books, not just because there's growth, but maybe because there's growth in a way that really was deeply unexpected. It simply came from continuing to live in the way that made sense to you. And that's what I think about grief work being, is not me telling you what to do, but you with support figuring your way forward. What makes sense to you? People tell me all kinds of things help them in grief. And I believe every one of those people.
Yep.
But what really gets hard is that pivot from looking at the past and yearning for the past and feeling brokenhearted about the past, and that thing that we all end up having to do, which is go live life. My family ended up driving across the country. We went to 28 national parks and monuments and 21 states, all these places that I had never. My husband was like, okay, if you don't want to go back to our house, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. I can't explain myself, but I really want to see the Grand Canyon. I'd never seen it. And God love my kids. They were much littler at the time, but they were like, great, let's get in the car. It's the kind. And I had said, a friend had taken a sabbatical and gone to all these national parks. And I was like, wow, that's not something my family would ever be able to do. So the never say never is really important. The not being all bright, shiny and saying, look, it's all going to work out. That's not what we're trying to say. What we are trying to say is you just never know what life has available for you. You would not have guessed this. We would not have guessed this. And yet here we are.
And I think that's it, is that, yeah, I wouldn't have imagined any of this. It was just about giving myself permission to say, let's try new things. Let's do something. And if it's awful, I'll quit. I tried some new things and I thought this is awful. And I did quit. And I put myself out there in some ways. And I thought, oh, it's not my thing either, but I'm going to try something else.
And yeah, we really guess. And then we adjust in relationship to the data. I'm going to let you go. I want to ask one question because I love asking this. Is there anything over the course of the trajectory of the grief that you experienced, was there anything that anyone did in support of you that really surprised you in being helpful? Anything that a friend or a family member just, wow, I didn't know that would be helpful. I really did hear you say about your mother-in-law being willing to jump out of planes. That sounds top level help.
That was pretty big, right?
Yeah.
My brother-in-law cleaned my house from top to bottom. He said, there's really nothing I can do for you. But he's not one of those people that would say, let me know what I can do. Yeah. He just would show up. And I'm talking toothbrush in the bathtub kind of cleaning. And not going to talk about grief and pain, but he said, I will do whatever I can. And everything from that to, I think, the people that really took action and said, probably grocery shopping after you lose your husband probably sucks. I'm going to go to the store with you. And I was so thankful that people in my life recognized those little things, and they didn't say, call me if you need anything. They like came up, right. showed up and said, let's do it, or I'll do this for you.
Okay. That's so good. That's so good. So those of you who are listening to this less as a griever and more as a supporter, just know muscling your way in and offering concrete support is a deep form of love that is really appreciated by grievers. Amy, if people want to find you and they want to book you to come talk and they want to know more about your work and what books are coming out, where is the best way for them to do that?
The best one is my website, which is Amy Morin, LCSW, as in licensed clinical social worker.com. You can find info about my podcast, which is Mentally Stronger with Therapist Amy Morin, and all of my books, which are also available on audiobook too.
This was such an honor and a complete delight. I would have started a podcast decades ago if I had understood that it meant all the people that I've been admiring, I could just invite them to come talk to me for an hour and they might say yes.
Well, I was so excited to be able to do this. So thank you.
It was a complete delight. Thank you so much for being here. And we will put in the show notes for anybody everything about Amy and how to get to her. And also remember that we always have 10 copies of the book. So if you want a copy and you can't afford it, just let us know and we will send you a copy of Amy's book. Thanks, everybody. And rate and review the show because that helps people know it's out there and listen to it. All right. Take care.